All right. Hi, Tom. Hi.
Jen.
So the discernment of information is sometimes not as easy, especially with all the concept learned intellectually. The metaphorical distance to the self grows because of searching and wanting. And when one realizes the true self, then questions fall away and you seem to be natural and authentic. Is that the authentic self that you described? Because there is, I wrote there that there is no fear, but I mean, there at that place, there is no real fear, but I can see the fear. And okay. If there is fear, it is seen and also passes, and it is not even seen as fear. So the funny thing is, if you get it intellectually, it will become even more interesting for the growth of one person. That's what I went through, because to see what belief creates reality, as which belief creates reality, it is a whole different plane. I will stop there for a moment.
Okay. No, I'm not sure just what your question is.
My question was the discernment of information, but you already answered it. So, I mean, yeah, I wasn't sure if I even should ask the question, but I'm not sure what else is coming now. So I may read the whole question if there is a question. I don't know.
All right. Well, you talked a little bit about being authentic. Yeah. An authentic self. Well, becoming an authentic self is really just getting in touch with who you are.
Yeah.
And you can be authentic and still have lots of fear. You can be authentic and still have lots of ego. You're authentic when you say, oh, here I am, and yeah, I've got all this fear, and oh, yeah, I've got all this ego, and I have these beliefs. That makes you authentic just by being aware of exactly who you are. And why you are, so you can say, all right, I made these choices, and I can see why. I made these choices because of my fear, because of my ego, and that's being authentic. And authentic's important because you can't change anything until first you own it. You can't get rid of anything if you don't own it first. So that's why authentic's important, to just see exactly who am I. You know, what makes me dance? What makes me move? What makes me do the choice, you know, make the choices that I make? Who am I? And why do I have these negative things in my life? Why do I get upset? Why do I get angry? Why do I feel insecure? Why do I feel unappreciated? Things like that. Because all of those negative things are tied to ego, which is tied to fear. So if you follow everything negative that happens, every feeling negative that happens to you, you'll trace that back to a fear and then become aware of that fear. Say, yeah, okay, that's me. I've got insecurity problems. I got this, I get that. And that's why I make these choices I do. Well, now you can actually change it. Once you become authentic, you can say, I don't want to be like that. But make sure you say, I don't want to be like that, and not say, I don't want to act like that. Because if you say, I don't really want to act like that, that's different. It's a totally different thing. And that has to do with your intellect becoming a good actor, you know, a good master. So, and you start doing things. You go, no, I don't want to act like that. So even though I feel really upset and angry and I'm annoyed, I'm going to smile and I'm just not going to show it. Well, that's acting. And it makes it more, you know, it makes it nicer for all the people around you if you're going to act better, but it's not going to help you grow up any. So once you have that intention, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to have that fear. And if you keep that intention strong and present in your mind, it's exactly what will happen. You'll stop being that way. Just the intention all by itself will lead you to do and feel the things you need to do and feel in order to get rid of the fear, in order to get rid of the ego and the beliefs, and then it'll all go around. So being authentic isn't like the end game. Oh, I'm going to be authentic and then I'm done. Being authentic is just step one, because what you want to be is authentic, and you can be authentic and have no fear. Well, now you're authentic. You know exactly who you are. And your choices all come from the heart, if you will. The choices are all choices because you are kind. You are caring. You do love. It is about other. That's what's motivating you. It's where all the choices are coming from. Well, now you're authentic and you're whole. You're there. But for most people, when they talk about becoming authentic, that's just the first step on a road of growing up. Because until you get to the point that you own it, you're stuck with it.
Okay. That pretty much answers my question. Yeah.
Good. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ingo, your question is next. Thank you.
Yes. Hello, Tom. I was inspired by Oliver's documentation to do some experiments, and I try to query the database with the help of play cards as a tool. I usually use three or four black cards and one red card, shuffle them and put them face down on the table. The red card means yes. Then I asking a simple yes or no test questions like, is today Monday or is the cat sleeping? And then I ask for visual or audio data, which of the cards on the table show me the correct answer, and then I turn the card around. I repeated this with different card games, different questions, open or close eyes. And I found out that this is a tool which is working for me. And I like it because I can calculate the probability on how likely it is to draw maybe 8 times the red card in a row. And then I ask some questions about a topic I've been worried about for some days. Question like, is everything going to be okay? Or is it going to be like I hope, all this high entropy stuff? And I became a bit obsessive with it. And after a while, this tool seems to stop working. It was a bit like, let's see when you get bored. And I think, as it was in this situation, it was a hint to stop doing that in this way. And I would like to know what you think about that, and if you can also get misinformation using such a tool.
Yes, you can get misinformation. Tool use has to be productive. You have to be learning. You have to be growing. You have to be lowering entropy, and then the tool just keeps on working. But eventually, when you said you got a little, obsessed with it, once the tool gets to where you have to know everything about everything, is this an auspicious time to go grocery shopping? Is this an auspicious time to, go talk to my boss? Where everything you have to run through this filter, consult the oracle, then the system is likely to not only stop giving you answers, but start giving you wrong answers. And it will do that because what you've done is give up your free will to this process. Well, this process knows so much more than I do. It's able to know things that I don't know. Then why should I be making these choices and not just get this process to search the oracle for the answer all the time? And now you've given up your free will. And that's not good because you can't learn anything if the choices aren't yours. Okay? So you did your card games and you learned that your intuition could be relied on, that it's pretty good and it worked pretty well for you. But then once you got past the point where it really was educational, it got past the point where now you were using it to know what to do next, using it to show other people you could do it, using it in any way you might want to use it rather than learning from it, then it starts to go away and starts to give you wrong answers. Particularly if it's the overusing the oracle function, getting more information about to make sure that you don't do the wrong thing. You know, it's like fear of messing up, the fear of getting it wrong. Well, I'm going to ask and ask and ask until I'm sure that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And that's not exercising your own free will. That's out of fear, the fear of doing it wrong, fear of not getting it right. And this other thing knows more than I do, so why don't I get it, do whatever it says, you know, and then I won't get it wrong. Well, the fear of doing it wrong is what's driving you now, and that's not good. So the system will stop working for you. Yeah, I've seen that happen with remote viewers, where remote viewers get really, really good at it, and they get so good at it that they start to get a little overconfident, a little cocky, they kind of brag about how good they are, and that's when they start getting misinformation. It's gone from something useful to their growth to something that's inhibiting their growth.
Okay, it still works, but I do it only one or twice a day, just for play wise, so to speak. But I had a time where I some days where I really was obsessed with it because I was worried and I had I can't ask no one, and so yes, I will stop doing that.
Yeah, you can overuse it. If you overuse it, then you tend to lose it. You have to just use it as it helps you develop down your own path. And play is okay. There's nothing wrong with play. But the play has to be positive. And it has to have a positive endpoint, whereas you're getting better and better. Your intuition is getting more and more reliable. You know, that's good. That's a good thing to learn, to exercise that intuition. But there's a point where it helps the fear, you know, like the fear of not being able to make the right decision, or the fear of not knowing as much as this voice or the thing in your head, and now you start giving up your free will. That's not good. And the fear of not making the right choice, that's not good. And you have to always remain skeptical. Just because you get a strong message doesn't mean that you need to do that. You know, you may get a very strong message that says, okay, today you must do this. You know, this is important. This is your mission in life. You know, you have to go do this thing. And if you think about it and you say, well, really, I don't feel too comfortable doing that. I really don't want to do that. Well, then don't do it. Don't just follow the voice against your own judgment. Because sometimes the voice will tell you things like that just to see whether you're going to act like a robot and do what you're told without a mind, or whether you're going to say, no, I know better than that. You know, whether it's going to dominate you or you're going to make the choice. And sometimes it'll challenge you that way. So always be skeptical of what and why. Always make your own choice. Yeah, you can take its advice and you can consider whatever advice it gives, but the choice has to be yours.
Okay. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom. I have some questions from Sandra. I don't know if you're aware of Burkhard Heim, but some of the questions are referring to his theory. Are there differences or similarities? He has a 12-dimensional theory. She also asked about, is MBT theory a deterministic approach similar to quantum chromodynamics and string theory and things like that? I think these questions and the one on the International Remote Viewing Association conference, we can answer for her separately, as those would be a little bit technical and you may not be familiar with Burkhard's theory. But I will ask her question number 4, have you noticed a neutrality behind the extensive complexity of love, or is love a formless energy frequency for all that is, which is feeding the matrix in its constant evolution?
I'm not so sure I understand exactly what that means, but
okay.
Like, let me talk about love in a little different way, and I can talk about those other things too a little bit. Maybe I'll answer some of her questions. Okay. And that is that no, MBT is not deterministic. It's probabilistic, as is our reality. It's probabilistic. It is a science, and it is as much a science as, you know, any other science, as much a science as is evolution a science, or even as quantum mechanics is a science, which means it's based on logic. It's based on some assumptions down at the beginning, just as so is physics and so on. You know, physics has assumptions like time exists, space exists, mass exists, gravity exists, spin exists. All those things exist, but they have no causes. There is no cause of mass or cause of time or cause of space. They just exist. So you have to bring them into a philosophy of science as assumptions, that they just exist. So most any science has its assumptions that are non-causal, that just exist. My model also has that, and that's that consciousness exists and that evolution exists. Evolution just being a process where you try everything and keep what works, and what doesn't work you discard. That sort of evolution. So our reality is probabilistic, not deterministic, as quantum mechanics has told us many times. And my model is also probabilistic and not deterministic. But it has a rule set. It's a virtual reality which is created by a rule set. And the rule set is dominantly deterministic. The rule set is the thing that defines energy exchanges within the virtual reality. That might be one way of saying it. It defines the possibilities within the virtual reality. You know, what can happen in there? Such as in a virtual reality, World of Warcraft, can your elf jump 20 feet in the air? No, it can't, because the rule set doesn't support elves jumping 20 feet in the air. Well, our reality is like that too. You know, does the rule set support a human being jumping 20 feet in the air? No, it doesn't support it. We're too heavy. You know, our muscles aren't that big. You know, the rule set says that human being isn't going to jump and go 20 feet in the air. And we'd say the physics doesn't support it. Well, that's saying the rule set doesn't support it. The rule set fundamentally is physics. It's the underlying rules that define what can happen and what can't happen within the reality, within a virtual reality. So the rule set is mostly deterministic. It's a set of rules that the way things can interact with each other, okay? But when you have a rule set and you have a virtual reality like this, it is hugely inefficient to develop your reality from the ground up. In other words, to build your reality from elementary particles up to neutrons and protons and electrons, up to molecules, up to physical things. If you develop your reality that way, it's just too much calculation. Start with elementary particles to then model, let's say, somebody, dancing on a dance floor. Well, all the changes in the biology, all the things the cells do, you know, the metabolism, everything that goes into that, if you do it at the elementary particle, it's an impossible calculation, much less to do this whole reality. It's just not efficient. So because you have this rule set that creates all the possible interactions, that rule set can generate probability distributions that describe things on a macro scale. And if you're describing things on a macro scale with probability, now you have a much more efficient process. And it doesn't have to describe things to any more resolution than the situation allows. So one of my examples is if you fire an old Civil War cannon, you don't have to do all the physics of all the molecules and, you know, of powder and of air and of other things and the barrel and the metal and the heating and the wear and all that stuff down at the molecular and atomic level. All you have to do is reach into a probability distribution and pull one out and say, all right, cannonball's going to land about over there. And that's good enough because nobody's measuring exactly where that ball's landing. Everybody's running around in a war, so it's just it lands where it lands. So probability distribution is good enough for deciding things in a macro world. You don't need the micro world to support it. It's run on probabilistic decisions. That's why the double slit experiment acts the way it does, because the world is probabilistic in its nature. And the system had to make that choice because of a boundary problem, a boundary value problem between particles and waves. So it had no other choice but to make the double slit experiment come out exactly the way it does. That's a logical, you can deduce that logic of why the double slit experiment has to be that way. That's the only solution. It couldn't be any other way. And so that'll answer some of those questions that Sandra had from the ground up. Now, when you have a probabilistic solution, when you have a probabilistic reality, it's very fast and very efficient. And anytime you do something new, you can go back to that rule set because it's a virtual reality. So everything that happens in the reality is built up from the rule set to begin with. So the humans in the virtual reality go around and they build a computer. Well, that's really a virtual computer because it's in a virtual reality and had to be built up from the rule set, you know, that built up things like, you know, chips and, you know, wires and all the rest of it had to be put there. And the logic of that computer is already there. So if you want to know the limits of what that computer can do and whatever, well, then the system can run a little simulation based on the rule set, come up with then probability distributions that describe its working in the macro world. And from then on, it can use those probability distributions to drive how it renders reality. So that's just it's a more efficient way to do the computer science to get the same result that we have here. And it's much faster and much more efficient. So that's the way MBT sees physical reality. They see it as a virtual reality. It's information based. It's in the macro, you get probabilistic renderings only to the level that's required. So if you do something that requires a lot of detail, like maybe smash atoms together over in Geneva, then you have to work down more at the rule set level, because that's the level at which the measurements are being made. If you have something like cannonballs coming out of cannons and landing someplace on a battlefield, well, then you don't have to have that much accuracy. You can have those cannonballs just kind of land wherever it looks like it might be all right, and that's good enough. That's the thing. You calculate consequences. So reality is rendered to various levels of accuracy, depending on the need of accuracy that's required by the players. So that makes it efficient. It doesn't have to render everything to, you know, 20 decimal places, starting with elementary particles, just because somebody sometime might want to see that. So that's just a quick run by that. Now, what about the love thing? Love is about other. Love is not about self. Love is about others. So love is a thing that's personal. It's the way people interact with their environment. Do they interact based on themselves? What's good for me? What do I want? What are my needs? How do I want things to be? That's ego. That's fear. It's based on fear because the fear says it's afraid that it won't get what it wants. It won't get its needs met, and it won't be... No, it won't get what it wants. So there's that fear. The fear says, I need to have these things. That's about the individual. It's not about other. It's about self. So that's not love. Most of the people in our culture don't fall in love so much as they fall in need. They have needs. They agree that they meet each other's needs, and they call that love. But it's really about them and their needs for the most part. And when their needs cease to be met, then it's time to get a divorce and separate. Because, again, it's about them and their needs getting met. It's not about other and what can I do for other and how can I make other happy. And it's not about their needs. So we get to love by letting go of fear. Once you let go of all the fear, then what's left is love. If you don't have any fear, then it'll always be about other. It won't be about self. About self is about fear. Fear is always self-focused. The fear is a me thing, an I thing. When you get rid of that I thing, what's left is it's about other, not about you. So that's how you come into love. You don't have to learn how to love. You have to learn how to get rid of fear. And as you do that, love is what's left over. It's fear that creates all the problems. So love is a individual thing. It's not a space that you get into. And it's not a collective thing. It's an individual thing. And individually, I mean, everybody, every individual has some love, some fear, some ego, some belief. That's kind of typical that you're a mixed bag. It's not like you're either all fear and ego, and then one day you get rid of it all, and then suddenly you become love. There's aspects to you that are not informed by fear, and those aspects then can be more caring about other. There's other aspects of an individual that are more self-focused, and then those things are more wrapped around the fear, the ego, and the belief. So a person has some aspects of all of it. For most of us in our culture, we are dominated by fear. Fear is the 80%, 85% thing that drives us. And love is the 10 or 20% thing that drives us. For most people, most of the time, it's about them and getting what they need. That's what's important. And when you have fear, you would listen to me say that and you'd say, well, of course, you know, I'm me. Of course it's about me. I mean, that's who I am, is me. So who else would it be about other than me? And that ego seems to be perfectly natural and perfectly acceptable and just the way it is, because most everybody's like that and you fit right in and everything seems like it's normal, if not really functional. But when it's about other, then it's not whether you get what you need, but can you help somebody else get what they need? Can you be of service? It's not what can I get, but what can I give? So that's what love is. It's letting go of fear about other, not about yourself. But we come in, you know, our relationships, like, take a mother and her newborn baby, right? There's a part of that that's just about the baby. And that's the love part. And there's a part of it that's also about the mother, what mom needs. And then that's not the love part. So we have these states of fear and states of love all going on at the same time inside almost everyone. But we tend to be mostly motivated by fear. And we'd like to turn that around and become mostly motivated by love. That would be the preferable way to live our lives. Because as we are mostly motivated by fear, we're unhappy. We seem to struggle in our life. Things don't seem to really work out the way we want or the way we need it. We have these hurdles we need to get over. If I could just get past this sticking point, everything would be great. But there's always another sticking point on the other side of that last sticking point. If I could only get out of this relationship and have a, you know, different one, everything would be great. But that's not really the way it works. You end up, it's not really that great either after a while, because it's not based really on love. Otherwise, there really wouldn't have been anything too wrong with the first relationship, but it was based on not getting your needs met. So I don't know whether I answered that question. I wasn't sure whether I got to what you were asking or not, but there it is.
Tom, it brought up something that you've said in the past that I love. I love this quote. Love is not just a nice idea. It is the fabric of our reality. I think that's more on the line that Sandra was asking, was it? Yes. Okay.
Yeah. She says well, yes. Well, love is the thing that we are aspiring to become. I mean, love's the reason why. It's the purpose. It's what we're here for. It's our mission is to get rid of fear and become love. That's why we exist. That's why IUOCs were created. That's what consciousness is all about. That's why we are interactive in this virtual reality. It's to get rid of our fear through trying to make better choices. It's how we make those choices, why we make those choices, that's the key. So love is what it's all about. Growing up, becoming love is the same as lowering entropy. Those two are equivalent. The only way we lower the entropy of our consciousness is to get rid of our fear and to become love. So it's the focus. It's the point. It's the purpose. That's what we are, and that's what we do, and that's why we're here.
Well, thank you, Tom. Paulina is still listening in, and she has one small question, and then we are saving the best for last. Cheryl will be the last. We're going to go over just a few minutes so we can be sure to get Cheryl's question in. From Paulina, I have a fear that my helping talking about problems practice will lead hardly traumatized person to some really depressive state as they start to see their responsibility for choices. If I get rid of this fear, which we were just talking about, would it be more effective for them who those who need to talk?
Okay, so person says that they're afraid if they talk to somebody and point out the responsibility that these people have, that most of their problems are self-created.
Yes.
Most of their problems are from their own choices. But that's just going to cause them to get more depressed.
Perhaps.
Okay. Well, what you need to do is, if you care about people, if it's about them and not about you, then you are sensitive as to the effect that you have on these people. And if you see that the effect that you're having on these people in your effort to help them is not helping them at all, but just driving them crazy or making them upset or making them feel guilty or something else, then you stop. You figure that is not a good thing. That's creating entropy, not lowering entropy. So you don't just tell people because it's the truth. You say, okay, here's the truth. You create most of your problems. It's your fear. It's your self-centeredness is making all your worries. That's why you're miserable and why you feel pain. It's you know, your choices. It's who you are. It's your low quality of consciousness. Well, that's some pretty rough talk. That's some stuff that, you know, you probably shouldn't say to anybody. You know, that's very matter of fact, blunt, in your face. That's not very sensitive. It may be the truth, but it's not the way to help somebody grow out of it. Just telling somebody the truth is not often helpful. You have to start from wherever they are, not from where you are. And then you have to talk to them in a way that you help them let go of fear and move toward becoming love. And if they don't move that way, then you stop pushing on that. You let them be who they are. So if you can help them by telling them things that help them choose to take more responsibility for themselves, great. But just telling them the facts and then leaving them there to stew in that juice is not helpful at all. That's more self-centered. Well, I told them the truth. It's up to them to do something with it. I did my part. That's their part. I tried to make them happy. You know?
I think a key element of her question is she has a fear. If
right.
She perhaps got rid of her fear of being affecting them this way, the approach might be a little bit more gentle.
Well, yes, I understood that. But you see, if she's sensitive to them, then she's not going to push them anyplace like that. As soon as she feels that that other person is retreating into themselves or objecting or feeling guilty or whatever, then she backs off. So if she's sensitive to other people, then she should not fear driving them into depression, because she should be sensitive enough to see that it isn't really working. They're not smiling. It's not making them happy. They're not feeling stronger. They're feeling worse. And then you quit. So it's just being sensitive to the person you're talking to. And if you're not helping them out, are you doing damage? So we don't think about what's the truth, and I need to get that truth to them. It's how can I help them? And telling the truth to them may not be what you need to do to help them. And yes, if you have any kind of fear at all, that's going to get in the way. Because if you fear that you might say more than you should, you might push it too hard, then you probably won't say anything. But as in all your choices, first you do due diligence. All right, I'd like to help this person. And then you assess that person and say, well, but, you know, I'll just probe very tenderly and very cautiously to see what's going on inside there. And I'll maybe offer some things very lightly, but see if they want to take the next step. And if they don't, well, then don't take the next step. You can't not do things because you're afraid that you don't know how to do it. You're afraid that you won't do it right. You see, it's like you can't do anything because you're afraid you might do it wrong. That's not the way to go forward. The way to go forward is do your due diligence, be careful, be aware, study up, you know what you're doing, know what you're about, be sensitive. That's what I call your due diligence. Decide what your best start, your best course of action, and then start doing it. And then be aware of the effect that you're having. And just do it as long as that effect is positive. And if you're not sure it's going to be positive, then change the subject. Back out. Do something else. And if it just happens that even that little bit of cautious steps you took were too much, and that person then goes into a depression, well, you tried your best. You did your due diligence. You didn't want to hurt, but you went too far. Learn from that. You weren't sensitive enough. Your due diligence wasn't deep enough. You didn't really understand how that other person felt. You didn't do your homework first, talking to that person and finding out where they are and where their limits are and where their buttons are. You just jumped right in. Then you learn something. Next time, you'll do it better. And you grow up. And you learn. So don't be afraid to give it your best shot. Give it your best shot. Shouldn't be shooting from the hip. It ought to be with due diligence, careful planning. Give it your best shot. And if it doesn't work out, learn from it. If it does work out, you're going to learn from it. You see? And then you try it again. And if that doesn't work out, and you've had two in a row that didn't work out, well, now you're going to have to go back and dig a little deeper about what it is you're doing that's wrong. And then stop doing it. Next time, do the best you can. You've learned a few things from the last two. And so it goes. That's how you learn. We learn by trying, by seeing our successes and failures and learning from them. And then going on again. I've seen many people get stuck in this thing. Well, I can't go forward because I don't want to make a mistake. I don't want to do it wrong. Therefore, I can't start it. I can't do it at all. Well, that's a stalemate that will make sure that you never grow, because you'd be too frightened to actually do anything. Just life will just kind of slide by you and you won't really be engaged in it. So don't be afraid to make a mistake. Just be careful, particularly if it's you're thinking that the mistake will be devastating to somebody. Then that's not a mistake you want to make. Just be careful. And go slow. Back up. If it takes you 6 months talking with that person before you get to even step one, take 6 months to do that. You don't have to do it all in one sit-down talk. That's too much, too quick. So be responsible and then just do it. Just go ahead. Learn from your errors. Learn from your successes. But don't be afraid to engage. You have to engage. So if you're feeling fearful of engaging, know that that's not helpful. Do your homework and just go do it.
Thank you, Tom. As sometimes it can take years. There doesn't seem to be any fast track.
No.
Okay.
Because you can't make anybody grow up. All you can do is help them grow themselves up. There's nothing you can do or say that kind of pushes somebody to grow up. And if you think you can do that, or push somebody to grow up, then that's a mistake. That's not due diligence. That's you wanting to control. You can't push people to grow up. They have to take the effort to grow up. Growing up is an inside-out thing. It's a personal thing. It has to be from inside of them. All you can do is give them an opportunity. And if you see that opportunity for them to grow themselves up isn't helping, back away from it. Try something else. Try another approach.
I know we got a little bit of a late start, but we are going to continue on for a few minutes with Cheryl's question, our last question. Please go ahead, Cheryl.
Well, speaking of just doing it, I had spoken to you about I was going to see my mother, and I hadn't seen her in about 10 years. So I faced a lot of fear, and I did that, and I went to see her, and it was a lovely visit. It wasn't anything like I thought it would be. It was a very lovely visit, and we were able to talk about some things that we had never been able to address before. And as I was sitting there and talking to her, I realized that she was like me in that our some of the abilities that I have, she also had them too. And I realized that she went through a lot of the same things about not being really accepted into the culture, you know, with the way we are. But I never really realized that before, that she was a lot like me in that sense. And then it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And I just kind of felt a little really bad that she didn't have any friends either. And I thought that was because of, you know, having children and all that. It was like, no, it was the same as mine, because I didn't either. I had maybe one or two friends growing up when I was young, and that was it. I had more later on. But so then I realized that the same thing happened to her, and that she was just trying to protect me from that happening to me. And that's how we kind of got tangled up as bad as we did. I was young. I didn't understand, really. And when I found that out, I thought that how much we don't know about what's really going on. And you think you do. But I think that I just made up things that there was some things there. But I just... Once when I found out that there was reasons behind some of the things that were going on, it just changed my whole perspective on the whole thing. But I just wanted to tell you thanks. And one of the things that I think my family faced is I thought all mothers were psychic. She would be waiting at the front door. If you came home and you'd been out causing problems, she'd be waiting at the door for you and ask you what you've been doing. And she always knew. And so I always thought that all mothers were that way. I didn't know any different. I wasn't around that many other mothers, but I thought they were all like that. And then as I thought about it a little bit more, it's almost like a big piece of my family, they're just like hiding because they're afraid to be who they are because of the taboos and the fears of the culture of anything that's about consciousness and what it can and can't do. And the things that my mother and me and one of my brothers is that way too, or we're doing, it's considered the devil's work in the religion that was around us at the time. And so I'm just kind of wondering if a lot of that stuff is coming from an old cultural standard, and then people are still trying to live up to that standard that doesn't work because everybody's not the same.
Well, you know how in the a little while ago in the near the beginning of this. We talked about everybody lives in their own personal reality. Well, you made up stories in your mind about what your mother was, who she was, and why she did the things she did, and you gave her motivations, and you made up the whole story inside your mind from the things that you had heard and seen interacting with her as a child. Of course, a child's viewpoint is a very small viewpoint. You know, a child doesn't have the big picture. A child just has a small picture, and they see things and interpret things and make up all their own stories. And so everybody's like that. Everyone lives in that same space, in that we all have our own unique personal realities. And in your reality, your mom was this person who maybe just didn't care or couldn't relate or other sorts of things, when that was just your story about her. And in her mind, she has a story, you know, about you and who you were and so on. And that was just her story. And the idea is that we have these stories that we build up in our mind about all of our relationships with people, all the people we're with, our spouses, our parents, our children. We have all these stories we make up about them. And in our reality, that's the way it is. In your reality, your mother was that way, you see. But that doesn't mean that that's really the way it is. And it doesn't mean that that's the way they are from their perspective and their reality, or even from your perspective now as an adult looking back, because much of your perspective was data you got as a child. You see, with the little bit of understanding that you have, you know, when you're a child. So the point is that it's so much better to just let people be whoever they are and just care about them and love them and not worry about all the stories we make up that describe their problems, their issues, and what they are and what they aren't and so on. It's just, well, let all that be. They are whoever they are. You know, that's not the point. You accept them that they're any way that they are, and you just care for them anyway and go talk to them and give them a hug. And then everything else takes care of itself, you see. All those stories then start to come together, and you start seeing things. But had you been able to do that in the beginning, you wouldn't have had the last 10 years being estranged from mom, because you wouldn't have, all that stuff would have just come out if you just could accept people the way they are and not hold grudges and not have fears and not have negative attitudes and not blame. All that's the fear and the ego stuff. And if we could just let that go and let people be and let us be ourselves, who we are, and everything will be all right. A whole lot of the world's problems would just disappear overnight if we just did that. Problems that only exist in someone's mind. They're not really real problems. They just exist in somebody else's mind. And that's the way most of your fears are. Most of the fears, once you actually find out what the truth is, they just puff into smoke and blow away. They're not really there. That's the nature of fear. So, yeah, a very good example of how that plays out.
I was shocked.
Yeah. Wasn't at all what you expected.
No.
Yeah. That's the way it is. And all of that image you had, all that negativity you felt, was all your own creation.
Was.
That's the way it typically is.
I've done a lot of work, and I'm working through it.
Yeah. That's typically the way it is. Most of the fear, most of the stress, most of the anxiety, you know, it's your own creation.
We make up stories.
Yes, we do.
That we can never know if they're... And we think they're true, but most of it's not.
That's right. Most of it's not.
Probably why.
And those stories, are there to justify the fear. You see, you got the fear, you got the negative, you don't feel good, and you make up a story to support it, to justify it. And then you believe the story. And then because it's a belief, that belief limits you. Now there's certain things you can't do and certain people you can't talk to and certain subjects you can't go to because you believe. Your belief keeps you apart from seeing it any other way. So that's generally the way it starts. We start with negativity, then we justify the negativity to make ourselves okay and somebody else to blame, and then we end up with a belief, and then we're stuck with that belief. And we can keep that belief all the rest of our life. And we're just stuck with it. That's why we should not have any beliefs, and we should always be open-minded and just let people be whoever they are. Because you can get into, you do live in your own reality, and you create that reality to a very large extent with the way you interpret the data that you get. And when you're a child, you interpret data very strangely because you only have a very small number of the facts. You don't have the big picture. So you create a reality that's based on a child's tiny viewpoint. But now you're, much older, but you're still carrying that belief around.
Yes.
Yeah. Just think of all the hurt and the misery and the lost opportunities that go by just because people are stuck in their beliefs and stuck with their fear.
Really sad.
Yeah. Sad.
That's sad sometimes.
Yeah. But the thing is, that's the way it is for everybody, and it's not just like relationships, like you and your mom. It's like people who, it's like anything that happens to you. People start to have making up stories. Let's say you get something in your data stream, and in your data stream, such and such and such a thing happens. It seems physical to you, or maybe it happened in an out of body or something, but things happen, and you start making up stories about it. And then pretty soon those stories become beliefs, and now that's your reality.
See?
And then you walk around in that reality, and that reality may give you a lot of fear and a lot of stress.
Yes.
But you walk along, you walk around in that reality, carrying that fear and carrying that stress. And that's part of your life. And that's what we mean when we say most of your stress, most of your pain is self-created. And when people hear that, they shake their head and say, yeah, maybe for other people, but not for me. My pain's because of them, and them, and them,
right,
and this terrible life I lived, and so on. And maybe other people create their fear, but I don't. Everybody sees it that way. But for the most part, our misery, our fear, our anxiety, our stress, all of that stuff that bothers us is our own creation.
Well, what an eye-opener this last week has been.
Yeah.
Thank
it's
you.
True of most of us.
Yeah. We're all doing that. We have to quit it. Get rid of these fears and beliefs. I think that would be just better for all of us.
Yes, it would be. But it's easy to see in somebody else's problem and very hard to see when it's your own.
Yes. But you can see it if you just keep working on it and looking at it.
Yeah.
Carolyn, if you have one short question, we can squeeze that in.
Carolyn.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Caroline.
I wanted to ask you a question because of network marketing or multi-level marketing. Because my company was working in that field here in Europe, and it's not very very welcomed here in Europe. People don't like that kind of business model here. But then I went to the US, and before and after the immersive, my boss took me to network marketing in the US, and it's very different over there. People are very welcoming this model, and but it's kind of with every product and with every company, it's the same thing. They kind of want to they can use the same techniques to sell something, and they really over push it, and they get their friends and family involved, and I wanted to know what if that's what do you think about it?
Well, the reason that that multi-level marketing has a bad reputation is that in the end there are a large number of losers and a small number of winners. Okay. That's why. is that in the end, if you look at it, you know, a year later or 10 years or 20 years later, there's a whole lot of people who didn't make anything at it at all, but invested a lot of time and energy and don't really get anywhere with it. But there's a few big winners. So it's a process that sucks money out of a whole lot of people up into the, you know, up to the top. And because it does that, it's some places it's illegal, some places it's discouraged. In some states in the U.S. they don't allow it. Other states they do, because it seems that, you know, most people are going to be losers. But it sounds great. You see, it's a great argument to get people in. All you have to do is sell it to five people, and each of those five sell it to five, and each of those people sell it to five, and, oh, you'll be a millionaire in no time. And it just sounds so easy, and, of course, it doesn't work like that, really. You can't do that. All of your five aren't going to sell it to another five, and all of them aren't going to sell it to another five, and that's just not going to happen. And people invest and they buy the products themselves because they have to stock it in order for them to sell it. So they end up buying a lot of products that they really wouldn't buy otherwise. And that's how the company makes its money. They make its money by preying on people's hopes and dreams. An easy way to make a lot of money, an easy way to get rich quick. And it sounds so simple. And they end up putting their money in, and they never get anything out of it. So that's why it's illegal places. That's why it has a bad rep. It sucks money out of the people at the at the outer levels. And if a lot of people want to be the beginning level of a multi-level marketing, because see, if they can say, okay, I just invented a new gizmo, and let's do multi-level marketing, because that way they can very quickly perhaps suck up a whole lot of money for themselves, and then if it dies 10 years later, well, that's all right, I'll make another one. And then they do another one, and I'll let one die out 10 years later, and I'll make another one. Each one, I end up with another, you know, $10 million in the bank, then pretty soon, it's really great. But it's great for the people at the top side. Not so great for the people after the product's kind of been pushed as far as it can be pushed, and nobody really cares that much about it, and it's less convenient than just picking it up at the grocery store, you know, something that's just as good or works just as well. It's just more convenient to pick it up at the grocery store when you go. So that's the problem with it. So in general, it's got a lot of promise, but not much delivery. Now, that doesn't mean that people can't do well with it, but like I say, there's only a few of those. But they get all of those and they round them up together to give a sales pitch about how great it is and how much, how they've gotten rich because of it. And there's, you know, 100, there's 10,000 people sitting in the audience, each trying to, you know, they're trying to psych them up. And they've got 10 people that come up and give talks about how they did it and they got rich, trying to get those 10,000 people to go out and start buying their products. You see, and that's generally the way it works. The few energize the many who toss in the money, and the few people suck up that money and go on. And then they find another 10,000 people to get the money out of them. So that's the reason it has a bad reputation. It's not that the thing won't work, and it's not that if you could get your five people to get five people to get five, if you could do all that, it would work just like they say. It's just that it almost never does. It's very rare that works. So your probability of getting rich quick in a multi-level marketing thing is if you start somewhere real near the top, and if the products are really, really so good that people will go out of their way to get them, and you're at the top, you know, two or three down from the top, then maybe that would be good. And when it all dries up, maybe you can put your $100,000 in the bank. But mostly not. And most people don't like selling. You know, doing hard sell to your family, you know, to get them to buy stuff because you're going to make money on them. People don't want to do that. That's why they're not going to go out and get five people. Nobody likes that hard sell stuff. You know, it's just not socially appropriate to be using other people like that. And then other people see you as using them. Oh, she's trying to get us to get in this, you know, level so that anybody that we get will pay her and so on. And it's, got its problems. I don't think it's illegitimate. I think it's a business model. It's just one that isn't favored by many states and or many countries because it leaves most of the people standing with their pockets empty after a lot of work and effort.
All right. Well, thank you, Tom. I guess we'll end this 58th Fireside Chat. And thank you to everyone who showed up and submitted your questions. For those of you in the MBT forum who submitted questions for this October one, we will be reading them first. There's only four, so we'll be all caught up, and your questions will be read first in the November Fireside Chat. So thank you, Tom and Oliver and Justin and everyone here. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks for coming, everybody.